This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
At 11 minutes after the hour of 5 o'clock here on this Wednesday afternoon, I'd like to welcome Jeff Looney to the program. He is the editor of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson, the retirement series at Monticello, right here in Central Virginia. Jeff, how are you? It's good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm glad you could spend some time with us. Of course, folks know I'm a big Jefferson fan, and I've really been looking forward to this conversation. We're going to get all the information about the research that you and your team do at Monticello on the retirement papers. Let's start first, though, with a Jeff Looney 101. Where are you from, and how'd you end up in this line of work?
Well, I'm originally from Maryland. I went to the University of Maryland as an undergraduate, but then I went to Princeton as a graduate student in English history. And from there, wanting to eat, I got a job also in Princeton working at the Papers of Thomas Jefferson project there. And we can talk more about how they're there and we're here.
Yeah.
But I spent a dozen years there as an assistant and later an associate editor. And then I went to Richmond for 3 years.
I have to say, just as an aside, yeah, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do that. Princeton is one of the most beautiful places in the country. It's a beautiful little town.
It is.
And really nice people.
Oh, yeah. We loved it there, and leaving there was quite a wrench.
Actually. Yeah, I bet it was. Well, it's good you got to come to Charlottesville eventually.
Thank you. Thank
so you go from Princeton then to Richmond.
That's
what was
right.
that about?
I spent 3 years in Richmond as the editor-in-chief of the Dictionary of Virginia Biography Project at the Library of Virginia. And this is an ongoing project to produce biographies of every important Virginian from Pocahontas until now. There's 3 volumes out and maybe another 9 to go. And it was just one of the most exciting things I've ever done, and loved the Library of Virginia. And there was really only one thing I could imagine that would have pulled me away, and that was the chance to come here and start the retirement series.
Any particular biographies you worked on as part of that series in Richmond that you'll always remember?
Well, I was particularly proud of the chance to work on Christiana Campbell of Tavern in Williamsburg fame.
I remember it very well.
That was great fun because I went there.
I had a few beers there once upon a time.
That's right. Well, I went to eat there later, and I met Christiana Campbell, the person who played her, and we had a nice chat about what she knew about this, and I would say something about Christiana Campbell. She says, yes, I remember when I did that. So that was kind of exciting.
You know you're in Williamsburg when people talk like that.
You do indeed. That's right.
So you got the offer then to come to Monticello.
That's right. Well, I've been here about 10 years, and this was the opportunity to come here because the papers have been printed and worked on in Princeton since they began in 1943. That was for the bicentennial of Jefferson's birth that this project began, and it had been going on ever since in Princeton. So in 1999, after kind of more than half a century, there was great delight in the scholarly community about the quality of the work being done and some despair about how long it was taking when scholars realized they were going to be dead before it finished. And the Thomas Jefferson Foundation decided to get involved, and they negotiated with Princeton University, and everybody decided to split the difference in terms of what was left and to keep the people in Princeton working through the presidency. And we would take over about half of the remaining period of documents by taking over from 1809 to 1826.
So that's hence the name, the retirement series.
That's right.
And so you're doing the retirement series is the work that's being done here at Monticello.
That's right. We're responsible for putting out what we anticipate will be about 23 volumes to get Jefferson from 4 March 1809, when he leaves the presidency, until 4 July 1826, when he dies. And so this is out of a total of perhaps 80 volumes to finish the whole thing. So it's just a massive enterprise. But the idea is to cover what the first editor of the project in Princeton called, but everything that is legitimately Jeffersonian by reason of authorship or association. And that includes, and one of the things that made this kind of a new idea in the 1940s, it includes all of the incoming letters as well as the outgoing letters. So the idea was, it seems kind of...
So the conversations that he would have with people.
Right. Yeah. It seems sort of self-evident now, but it was kind of a new idea at the time that to understand Jefferson's letters, you have to have the letters he's responding to. So as you say, it's the conversation, and it includes letters he didn't respond to, because if you don't have the whole corpus, you don't know what he decided to answer and what he chose to ignore.
It's just a huge project. We're talking with Jeff Looney. He's the editor of the retirement series of the papers of Thomas Jefferson, and you can learn a whole lot online at monticello.org/papers. Jeff, tell me how this started at Princeton and not at the University of Virginia, because if Jefferson knew that, he might be a little upset about that.
It's one of our most frequently asked questions. The reason is that in the 1940s, in 1943, there were two big projects that people had in mind for Jefferson's bicentennial. One was building the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, and the other was to start this massive project to do the Jefferson Papers. And one of the leading historical editors in the country was the librarian of Princeton University, a man named Julian Boyd, who had just done a major study of the Declaration of Independence and the drafts of it. And so he was asked to do a feasibility study, and he did one that was so good that they said, not only should we do this, you're the man to do it. So they actually hired him there, and it's been at Princeton ever since. And
it's an institution at Princeton.
It is, yeah. And it's always been regarded as one of the flagship projects in documentary editing, and still is, I think.
Now tell us, we talk with Ted Crackle on a regular basis about the George Washington Papers, which are at UVA.
That's right.
And what is this project? What exactly do you do? When we talk about, you know, your particular bailiwick, which is the retirement series, on a day-to-day basis, so folks have an idea, what is it that you and your team are actually up to?
Sure. Well, the key thing to remember is that a documentary editor is not like, say, a newspaper editor. Our job isn't to take the prose and change it and improve it. The most important thing we do is to give totally reliable transcriptions of the letter as it was written, so that you're not obliged to ever wonder whether if you went back and looked at the original document, you'd find all these errors in it. So the most important thing we do is to take the document and transcribe it and then check that kind of obsessively until we're ready to put it out there, and people will be able to rely on that kind of forever after. The other part of what we do is to annotate it to provide some background that will make sense of it.
And that's where all the research comes in.
Well, there's research on both sides. One of the things we learn increasingly about when you're trying to transcribe a document is that to some extent you can't figure out what the word is until you know what word it would make sense to be there. We were just a few days ago, we realized that a word we had been transcribing as the Maritime Laws of Oberon, and we couldn't make any sense of that. What did Oberon mean? And you had to do a lot of research until we realized we had misread it, and it was actually Oleron, and that Oleron was a German location that had a code of laws in the 16th century, and that was what it was. So you know, the research really begins with the transcription, because if you're trying to read a name, you got to sort of know what name could be right before
read
it.
Yeah, it's a great point.
But the annotation is, you know, it's a big part of what we do, and one of the things to remember there is we try to be lean and mean in the annotation. You know, it's possible to get distracted and write sort of pages and pages, and that takes us away from our job. Our job is to get those documents out so other people can use them, and not to put in a lot of sort of dated stuff now or citations to books now that will become obsolete over time. So we try to stay very closely to the primary sources. An example would be if somebody talks about the big fire in the city last week, we would find a newspaper account and say what happened, how many houses burned down. But we wouldn't then go on into a long paragraph about the history of colonial firefighting. That's the job of other people to put these things in context.
Yeah, and this work is published as, you know, hardback volumes. Is that it?
That's right. It's been published by Princeton University Press from the beginning. And when the Thomas Jefferson Foundation took over the retirement series, part of the deal was that we would also be published by Princeton University Press. So it would be one uniform edition.
Yeah,
and that's still what we do. But so we're here, and we are sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Foundation. They raise the money, and to me, it's just the most amazing thing that a house museum would take on this major scholarly project. I think that's unique, and it says a lot about our commitment to research here.
Yeah, because usually those type of places they just give tours of the house, and Monticello does
We do a great deal more.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And it's, you know, research projects of this type are almost always at a university or a major research library.
Again, folks, it's online at monticello.org/papers. We're talking with Jeff Looney. He's the editor of the retirement series of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson. It's at Monticello. And again, the website, monticello.org /papers. I'm curious, there was something in the news lately about a new Jefferson letter that was found, I think, in Delaware, and it sort of opens the door to this question of what do you do when you find new stuff? Because I'm sure there's more letters to be found.
In our period, we have about 15,000 documents already on the shelves just for the retirement period. Jefferson is thought to have written himself maybe 18,000 letters in his life and to have received many more than that, at least 25,000 written to him. So there are many, many possibilities out there. One of the things about Jefferson is that makes him almost unique is he had a record of all the letters he wrote and received for most of his life. You kind of log them in and out, written, received. So you know, actually, when you're missing a letter because you've got this kind of roadmap he left. So we know that for the retirement period, we have some kind of a text for about 90% of the total corpus of documents. That means there's 10% still out there. But the other thing is Jefferson kept a copy of almost every letter he wrote. He had this polygraph machine you'll see if you visit Monticello. So he would make a copy and he'd send a copy. So many times what will turn up in somebody's attic will be the copy that got sent. And I believe that's what was found in this case in Delaware.
So that wasn't a letter that had never been seen before.
I haven't checked in this specific case because it's pre-retirement, but it's almost certainly one that was already in one of the major collections for the polygraph copy. So it's still exciting, and it's important in scholarly terms because he could have added a postscript that didn't get onto his retained copy. So unless you know what he sent, you can't be absolutely sure. But it's often the case that what turns up is the recipient's copy where there's already a retained copy. And we want it all, but that's very important. But that's not, it doesn't excite me in the same way that something that might not be in Jefferson's hand, but that is if it's the only known text, then that means we can print it.
And without it,
we can. And a great example of that happened for us. One of our most exciting moments of the retirement series, a few years ago, we discovered the last known letter that Jefferson wrote, which dated a day later than the previously latest letter.
Cool.
And we were very excited, but that was something that one of my colleagues discovered at the Virginia Historical Society. And the reason it hadn't been found earlier was in somebody else's collection of papers because it was a copy. It wasn't in Jefferson's hand. But the ones in his hand had all disappeared. So, this was a huge scholarly moment for us, even though it wasn't, a Jefferson handwritten thing.
When was the last letter?
Well, the last letter was written I should know this by heart. I'm going to blank on it, but it was late June 1826, and it was
just a few days before he died.
Very few days before he died, and one of there was a letter he wrote on the day before that had been previously always talked about as Jefferson's last letter, in which Jefferson declined his invitation to appear at the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in Washington. And so he wrote this marvelous letter, a kind of a last farewell to America and expressing his faith in the American democratic experiment. And we'd always known in the Jefferson biz that he wrote two letters the following day from this Journal of Letters I'm talking about, but I never expected that we'd find one. We did, and this new letter, now replacing this marvelous political testament, was a letter in which he arranged for the payment of duties on a shipment of wine. one of the leading Jefferson scholars who recently died, Merrill Peterson, wonderful man. I understand he said something to the effect of, I wish that Looney and his colleagues had left well enough alone because he liked this other letter. But it was, on the other hand, hugely exciting to the wine lovers among us.
Absolutely.
I thought this was just fantastic news. So.
Jeff Looney is my guest. He is the editor of the retirement series of the papers of Thomas Jefferson. It's online at Monticello.org/papers. I was thinking when you were talking earlier about this polygraph machine, mm-hmm. Did he pick that up in France? And I'm curious how common that was for people at the time to be using one of those, or was he just one of the only people that had one?
There weren't many of them, and this wasn't the first copying machine he got. The thing about Jefferson is, at that time, a good man of business kept a copy of all of his letters. And John Adams said to one of his sons, whatever you write, keep a copy. And he did. But most people were content to have a letter book into which they would copy it. Jefferson did not think that was good enough. He wanted a mechanical representation like a photocopy now because he didn't want any copying errors. So what he first got in the 1780s was a letterpress in which you would apply while the ink was still wet. You would take your letter and some wet tissue paper and apply pressure to it, and the ink would soak into that tissue paper. And that was what he would use as a copy. And that's what we have as the main source of our copies from the 1780s until the early 1800s. And in fact, we have one of those up in Monticello as well. But then in 1803 or 4, he acquired a polygraph. And this was
During his first term as president.
During his first term as president. And this was a machine that you can see this in Monticello also. It's a machine where you have two pens, and as you move one pen, the other one moves in tandem and creates a very, very close copy. If you hold the two up, it's hard to tell which is which. And so they're marvelous to use. In fact, one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me was to move from Princeton, where we were reading these very blurry, hard-to-read press copies, to my job at the retirement series, where they have these polygraph copies that are very easy to read. So it was lucky for me as far as that goes. Well, there weren't many of these polygraphs. They were a bit hard to keep in repair. It was designed by an English inventor named John Hawkins, who developed a partnership with Charles Wilson Peale, the great American painter and inventor. And Peale was the one who told Jefferson about it. And Jefferson immediately wanted one and got one and kept using them for the rest of his life.
What did he do with the copies? Was there like a folder in his library, or what would he do with these things?
Well, he kept this journal of letters. He'd log them into this journal along with his incoming letters, and then he would keep them in alphabetical order in a series of letter presses, kind of pieces of furniture he designed to hold this stuff. So he could turn to any letter that he'd written very, very quickly, because he had the journal of letters by date, and then he would index those from time to time by alphabetically. So, and that's how they were organized. So he could really find everything very quickly. When he died, his material was probably the best archive for an American founder of that period that ever existed.
Amazing. Was he just, and you know this guy so well, or certainly in the last period of his life, having spent years reading his letters and the letters to him, was he just obsessive compulsive, or was this just something a man of the Enlightenment did? You documented things and you kept records, whether it was your garden or the weather or the letters you wrote and received.
I think a man of the Enlightenment was interested in everything and kept records and everything, but Jefferson goes kind of way beyond way beyond pale. I mean, this is a man who kept a weather journal, where for much of his life he was keeping temperature and other kinds of weather readings twice a day. And this is a man who has this journal of letters. This is a man who has a farm book in which he records information about what's going on in his farm, and a garden book in which he keeps track of his garden plantings. And one of the things we've printed in our volumes quite recently is a smaller but equally fascinating document, which is called his Notes on Household Consumption. Jefferson, in his he's got records, his financial records of kind of every penny he spends and receives, but that just tells what he spent it on. It doesn't tell how long it lasted. So he had to have his separate notes on household consumption, where he would say, well, we killed a beef cow. And then he would say 3 weeks later, the beef ran out. Had to order more brown sugar. This is how long it took for that. And at one point, he records how many loads of wood it took to keep his personal fireplace in his bedroom going in a cold winter at Monticello.
Amazing. He records everything.
Every time he fills the wood box, as it were.
So, yeah, amazing.
He's an extraordinary record keeper. And I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't explain it to that level. But I do think he had a great desire to kind of have an understanding of his world and some sense of control over what you could never really control being a farmer, So
yeah.
He did the best he could with that.
We're talking with Jeff Looney. He is the editor of the retirement series of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson at Monticello, online at monticello.org/papers. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour, get a local news and weather update, and we'll continue our conversation on the other side. This is Charlottesville Right Now. Jeff Looney is the editor of the papers, the retirement papers of Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. It's online at monticello.org/papers, and we're honored to have him live in studio. Jeff, let's talk a little bit about some of the content of what you're dealing with the retirement papers. And again, this is 1809 March of 1809 when Jefferson came back to Charlottesville, leaving Washington for the last time, and fought through that big snowstorm to get home. And he comes home and he stays there. Let me ask you first, I find it very interesting that he did quite a bit of traveling in his life, and yet when he retires from 1809 until when he dies in 1826, a time when most Americans seem to do most of their traveling, he does none. He never leaves the state.
It's true. After he gets home from Washington, he never leaves the state of Virginia again. He does travel pretty regularly down to his other home in Poplar Forest, and he goes there 2-3 times a year for much of his retirement. But besides that, he makes a trip or two to Richmond and not much else. He seems to be very happy to have left those times behind him, and he always talks about it as kind of a sailor who's been on a stormy sea getting home to harbor and kind of wants to stay that way, I think, thereafter.
Yeah. Do you think were there any entreaties or anything, any invitations to come back to Europe? Was that ever an interest of his? Do you know?
Well, I think he and his he keeps many dear European friends, and they tend to indulge in these kind of competitions to each try to persuade the other to come back to visit them. I certainly read some very eloquent letters by Jefferson to friends in Europe, urging them to come back, including an old boyhood friend in Liverpool who had gone there from Virginia, and he says, "Oh, you should come back, and we could ramble through the hills we used to know together." It's a wonderful letter.
Yeah,
but he's not to be persuaded himself. There's a fairly serious proposal by somebody that Jefferson come back to solve the nation's problems as Secretary of State in 1812, and Jefferson has no interest in this at all.
Jeff Looney, he's the editor of the retirement series of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson. The phone lines are open, 977-1070, if you've got a question or a comment. Anything in the retirement papers refer to Sally Hemings or the Hemings family? I've got to ask that.
We haven't read every document that's coming up, but certainly for the period we are in, we don't have any significant references to Sally Hemings by Jefferson himself. One of the things we're trying to do to extend the scope of our work has been to obtain new documents in two areas that had not been originally part of the Jefferson Papers master plan. One is family documents, by which I mean letters from members of his family to other people rather than to Jefferson himself. And the other is visitor accounts, people passing through and visit Jefferson at Monticello and describe their experiences there. And we did have one visitor account we did print that referred to Sally Hemings, and this person expressed his opinion the story was true.
Really? Interesting.
But we don't have...
Based on what he saw when he was there.
Based on his conversations, mostly with people at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can say they were malcontents or whatever, but our job is to print this stuff and not to tell us what it all means.
Yeah. Now, we were talking during the break, and I did not know this, and found it very, very interesting that most of the letters that you will publish in the retirement series, people have never seen before. This is new stuff.
Yeah, it's certainly not new to scholars in the sense that the major Jefferson collections have been on microfilm. But 2/3 of the letters by Jefferson that we are printing have never been printed anywhere before, never been transcribed and published. And 80% of the letters to Jefferson have never been printed anywhere before.
Wow.
And the numbers, and even that is kind of a misleadingly large number out there, because that means that if it's ever appeared anywhere, so that would mean that if a single letter appeared in some magazine article 10 years ago, we would still say, well, that's previously published. So if you tried to look at previous editions of Jefferson, the proportions that were accessible in one place before are much, much smaller than that.
But that's incredibly exciting. So the work that's coming out of your shop then is just, this is, people should be really rushing to buy these volumes because the most people have never seen these letters before or these this side of Jefferson.
Well, that's true. And you know, one of the things I like about working with Princeton University Press is that they keep all of the earlier volumes in print. Many of these editions, they you know, there's limited press run and that's it. But the Princeton University Press keeps them all in print. And in fact, if you go to the Monticello Visitor Center, you can buy all the volumes. They're out there right now.
And how many volumes have been printed since published since 1943 when it started?
Well, there are 35 volumes of the first series, the chronological series, out. There are 5 volumes of the retirement series. And there's also what we call the second series, a topical series, which has 5 volumes out. And by that, I mean things that didn't lend themselves to being done chronologically. For example, there's 2 volumes of Jefferson's accounts, his memorandum books, that were actually kind of a previous editing effort at Monticello, because they were edited by Jim Baer and Cinder Stanton, a former director here and a current staff member here.
Yeah.
And that's a remarkable document, because that's 2 volumes worth of kind of every penny he spent and and received while for essentially his whole life from the 1760s on. And it's a great example, again, of Jefferson's attempt to gain control over his the world he lived in. But the sad thing about it is he I think gave him a false sense of security, because he could point, and he was proud that he could point to all of his expenditures and income, but he didn't keep a running account, so that about 3 times in his life he would actually cast the accounts and figure out where he stood. And each time he's horrified. He was much worse in the hole than he thought he was. So
that's
kind
great.
Of like keeping a checkbook, but never balancing it.
Yeah, because he was horrible with money, wasn't he? I mean, a guy who lived on credit.
Well, everybody in his time lived with credit, but yeah. but Jefferson had some bad luck. But it's also true he lived beyond his means for a great deal of his life. So you know, we have many documents we're printing that are substantive and exciting. But I have to admit that we also have many documents that show many different ways to say, I'm sorry I can't pay you just now, but I definitely will pay you as soon as I can.
Really?
Yeah, it's a kind of an art form. And I don't think he's the only one who mastered that. But certainly that's some of these letters. But I could say more generally that for the retirement, we are dealing with as I say, there are huge amounts of previously unpublished material about his finances, and that's very valuable and interesting for social and economic historians. A lot of material about legal issues. Jefferson spends a great deal of time trying to sort out who owns bits of his land that he thought he owned, which is another thing that happens with Virginia gentlemen all the time at this period, is you're always suing and being sued for who really owns what pieces of land. He gets all kinds of material. All kinds of letters, wonderful letters from a huge circle of acquaintances and people he doesn't know at all. So that we are printing an amazing corpus of letters between Jefferson and John Adams after they make up their former feud and become very good friends again. And some of those letters are just so interesting and exciting. But it extends from that kind of correspondence down to somebody who will write a single letter to Jefferson. One of my favorite is somebody who writes Jefferson a letter, says, somebody and I are having a dispute to settle a bet. Did you ever visit England and see the King of England? And much to my astonishment, because normally Jefferson just kind of ignores these things, he actually sat down and wrote a nice letter back. He said, as it happens, I did meet the King of England.
That's great.
Kind of gives the date. So there's just a huge variety. And the most important things we've got for this period in public life would be in this volume, we're just starting to come into the period where the British burned Washington, and we, as a nation, made lemonade out of lemons by Jefferson selling his library to the nation to replace the Library of Congress, and thereby changed a sort of narrowly focused legislative reference library into the great cultural institution it is, kind of single-handedly by turning his library over to the nation.
Can you really see the sort of backstory on that sale and the thinking that went into it in the letters?
You can. I mean, Jefferson, in his letter, too, he writes almost immediately to a friend and asks him to present this idea to Congress. And he says, you know, I had always intended to keep this till I died and then to find the right home for it. I've been worried about the right home for it, because he knew it was a really important collection of books. And he writes to and says, now I think I should offer it to the nation, but only on condition that they buy the whole thing. And that indeed became an issue with a lot of congressmen saying, we don't need all this stuff in foreign languages. We don't need all this stuff on these subjects. But Jefferson said, you know, in principle, there's nothing that a member of Congress might not need to have access to.
Yeah.
And that was really, I think, what opened it up as becoming a reference library for the nation, not just
how
for,
many volumes for was that? How many books do you know? I hate to ask you that. But
off the top of my head, I'm not absolutely sure, but there were more than 10,000 volumes. The problem is, how do you count a volume?
Yeah.
Because Many of them would be multi-volume reference works.
The reason I ask is, I'm curious, where were they? I mean, I've toured Monticello many times, and you think, okay, before he sold his books to the Library of Congress, where would they have been in this house?
Yeah, I've asked myself the same question. There's no doubt at all that what we call the library was where some of the books were.
Yeah.
There's just no way they were all there.
No, it's not that big.
No way they were all in that wing. And I have to think, as an inveterate book collector myself, that like most book collectors, they wound up all through the house.
Right. The museum would have been something of a library as well.
I doubt. I don't think he would have had it available to the kind of the world wandering in. But I think the second and third floor is probably were a very different story. The curators would know more about this than me, but I rather suspect that the dome room eventually became an annex to the library, for example.
Interesting. We're talking with Jeff Looney. He is the editor of the retirement series of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson. And you can learn more online at monticello.org/papers. And you can buy copies of the volumes of the papers at the Monticello Visitor Center. Dave is waiting very patiently on line one in Charlottesville. Dave, you're on with Jeff Looney. Go right ahead.
Great show tonight. Hey, Jeff, I wondered if there was any writings around the time of the founding of the university. When you take a tour of the rotunda, they describe a story of Jefferson sitting or standing at a window and looking out over the university right after it had opened, I guess admiring his handiwork. Is there any writings to know what he was thinking and contemplating when he sat there for hours looking out over his newly founded university?
What a great question. And, of course, the retirement series, everything about UVA is going to be in the volumes that you and your team work on.
Yeah, that is a great question. And one of the things we're very excited about, the most important kind of public contribution he makes in retirement is the founding of the university, as he himself thought, because he wanted that as one of the three things on his tombstone. But we have not yet published that material because it's in the latter part of the retirement, and we're proceeding forward chronologically. So we're dealing with kind of 1814 right now. But in fact, the volume we are currently working on and about to submit to the press is going to include an editorial note describing the very, very beginnings of Jefferson's attempt to found the university. And what he did was to become a trustee of the Albemarle Academy, a kind of a small, moribund local school that had been authorized, but nothing really had happened. And he, after like 10 years of nothing happening, he turned up at a meeting of the trustees and became a trustee and almost immediately began pushing them to set their sights much larger. And so over the next...
Because it had been something of like a local high school.
Well, it was nothing, but that was the idea. You would create sort of a local high school. And he said, you don't want an academy. What you want is a university. So we've got letters in this volume we're working on where he talks with some of the leading American educators and gets their ideas about what a great university should do. And he just starts building up kind of information on that over the next few years. And eventually they convert the Albemarle Academy into Central College and from that into the University of Virginia. And he is involved in every phase of the creation of the university. He helps, he's the first rector, the first head of the visitors. He hires the faculty. He designs the buildings. He oversees the buildings. He helps write the disciplinary codes.
He told them where to put the outhouses. I mean, he was involved in everything.
We've got the drawings for that. I think my favorite story as an editor is the moment in the last year of his life when they are unboxing and putting up books for a major purchase of books that really is getting the library of the University of Virginia going. And he takes a look at these books and he says to the librarian, well, you should have rejected this book as soon as it arrived. And the guy said, well, why? And he shows it to him. He says, well, there's an error on the on the title, on the binding. Should have sent that back and got it fixed. So he was a good documentary editor after my own heart.
Yeah, and there was also the books in the library. He didn't want some of his political enemies' books in the library, and Madison told him, you can't do that. We got to have all the books, all points of view in here.
He might not have objected so much to them going in the library, but he was very definite about what he wanted taught. And one of the things he wanted them to do was to reissue a history of England that he thought was too loyalist, too Tory, And so he wanted to have a sort of a Baudelaireized version of it that took out all that stuff and made it a good Republican, lower R Republican history that didn't corrupt the students there.
Jeff, this is great stuff, and we've got to have you back. Would that be okay? Can we do this again?
Sure, absolutely.
We'll look forward to that. Jeff Looney, he's the editor of the retirement series of the Papers of Thomas Jefferson. Check it out online, won't you? Monticello.org/papers.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.